John Washington, writer, translator, and activist. He's a regular contributor to The Nation magazine and The Intercept, where he writes about immigration and border politics, as well as criminal justice, photography, and literature. We've been talking about his new book, The Dispossessed, A Story of Asylum at the U.S.-Mexican Border and Beyond. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Do follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RUWithSonali.
Rising Up with Sonali is hosted, written, and executive produced by Sonali Kohatkar. Anna Buss is the producer, technical director, and web and social media supervisor. Our theme music is by Grammy Award-winning band Gets Up. Like us on Facebook.com/RU with Sonali. That's the letters RU with Sonali. And follow us on Twitter.com/RU with Sonali. Our website is risingupwithsonali.com, where you can find all our programs archived and where you can get direct access to all our video and audio files.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.
Today is Cinco de Mayo, a holiday with roots in Mexico, but today mainly celebrated in the United States. But with coronavirus, celebrations will be tamped down this year as we focus on the impact of the virus on the most vulnerable essential workers and the economic impact of the virus, which has resulted in a series of rent strikes across the country. We discuss Cinco de Mayo and its historic roots, and more about the little-known Mexican history with Dr. Gabriela Buelna, faculty member in Chicano Studies at Cal State Northridge. And what is the situation on the ground in Mexico, which, like other countries, is struggling against the coronavirus? Prior to the virus, what were the social movements making themselves heard in Mexico, and what has been the government's response? What about the deal the government of Mexico was forced by the Trump administration to accept on the issue of migration? What are some of the socio-political and economic challenges facing Mexico today? We speak with Jose Luis Granado Ceja, a journalist based in Mexico City. And what about immigrants to the United States from Mexico and other parts south of the U.S. border? What has been the impact of COVID-19 in terms of health and economics of that community? We speak with Kenya Alcacer, a community organizer with Union de Vecinos based in East Los Angeles and a co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign California, a national call for moral revival. Kenya and her organization are among the organizers of a series of rent strikes in Southern California as part of a global national movement, and it's also growing globally. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandari. A University of Washington institute that the Trump administration has relied on for projections of coronavirus deaths has doubled its revised estimate of the U.S. death toll by August. The Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation previously predicted 72,000 dead by August. It now says its latest model predicts more than 134,000 U.S. dead by then. The Institute's director, Chris Murphy, said the earlier estimate was based on the assumption that shelter-in-place orders would stay in place until the end of May and people would obey them. He told CNN the revised model is based on the new reality on the ground.
The big driver here of the big change is that we're taking into account the states that are relaxing social distancing, and we're also seeing in the mobility data that collected through anonymized cell phone use, people are already increasing their mobility even before the mandates have come off, even in states that still have mandates in place. So that's driving up, you know, transmission, and that's driving up our numbers.
The New York Times reported that an internal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention document projects a sharp jump to 3,000 deaths per day in the U.S. by June 1st. Johns Hopkins University data shows nearly 69,000 U.S. deaths so far, far higher than any other country. The global death toll stands at more than a quarter of a million. California Governor Gavin Newsom has announced changes to California's stay-at-home order that could let some businesses open their doors as soon as Friday. Newsom said he'll release the guidelines on Thursday. Christopher Martinez reports.
Governor Gavin Newsom calls it Phase 2, a plan to start the process of reopening businesses shut down in the wake of the coronavirus pandemic. He's starting with what he calls lower-risk businesses in the retail sector to allow curbside pickups.
As early as the end of this week, you will have the capacity as a retailer with the modifications and the guidelines we set forth on Thursday to begin to reopen for pickup clothing, bookstores, music, toys, sporting goods stores, florists with Mother's Day coming up.
Under the Phase 2 plan, counties will create their own local plans for reopening under state guidelines based on approval from local public health officers and boards of supervisors. The state will have a final say on whether the plans are working, but Newsom says he's confident the local governments will continue what he calls good work on preparations to reopen. I'm Christopher Martinez.
New York, which has been the epicenter of the pandemic in this country, has reported more than 1,700 previously undisclosed deaths at nursing homes and adult care facilities. An Amazon executive says he quit his job to protest the firing of workers who spoke up about conditions inside Amazon's warehouses and the company's record on climate change. Tim Bray, a vice president at the company, wrote in a blog post he left his job last week in dismay after Amazon fired several workers who publicly criticized the company. He said the firings were evidence of a vein of toxicity running through the company culture. Britain has become the first country in Europe to confirm more than 30,000 coronavirus deaths. Prime Minister Boris Johnson plans to soon detail a route out of the nationwide lockdown that began March 23rd. Critics say Johnson's government responded too slowly when COVID-19 began to spread, failed to contain the outbreak by not widely testing people with symptoms, then failed to trace and isolate the contacts of those infected. In Russia, the number of infections rose sharply again, with officials reporting more than 10,000 new cases for the third day in a row. Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro says authorities arrested two U.S. citizens among what he says was a group of mercenaries trying to kill him. The arrests come a day after a deadly beach raid near the Caribbean nation's main port city that left 8 people dead. Maduro appeared on state TV holding up U.S. passports belonging to the two, both of whom are former U.S. Special Forces soldiers. Maduro says they prove the U.S. is plotting his ouster.
Mike Pompeo was betting on this attack and believed that this attack would end the revolution and the Constitution, overthrow the government, and kill me. God save us and protect us.
A Florida-based ex-Green Beret said earlier yesterday he was working with the two men in a mission intending to detain Maduro and liberate Venezuela. The Senate Intelligence Committee is set to consider Texas Congressman John Ratcliffe's nomination to be Director of National Intelligence. President Trump unexpectedly renominated Ratcliffe in February after his name was withdrawn for the post last summer. That withdrawal came after bipartisan Senate criticism that Ratcliffe was unqualified. I'm Eileen Alfandari for Pacifica Radio.
This is your host, Margaret Prescott.
Today is Cinco de Mayo, in English, the 5th of May, a day in which many in the United States have come to associate with parties and alcohol. But in reality, it represents something much more profound than what we've been told in the mainstream media. Many people mix it up. They think that it's Mexican Independence Day. It isn't. The Battle of Puebla, as it is known and celebrated in Mexico, took place on March 5, 1862. The battle took place near the heavily indigenous city of Puebla in central Mexico during the second French invasion of Mexico. Napoleon III of France had invaded Mexico after the country's first indigenous president of Mexico, Benito Juarez, instituted a two-year moratorium on loan interest payments to French banks. This, however, was simply an excuse to expand the Second French Empire at a time when it was losing control of its colonies around the world. Decades earlier, French colonizers were soundly defeated by the people of Haiti, who won their independence in 1804 and established the first Black Republic. Meanwhile, the Battle of Puebla resulted in a victory for the Mexican army, decades after the Haitians defeated the French army. This despite the French having a larger force and being better equipped militarily. The route taken by the French toward Mexico City, the nation's capital, was defended by the people of Puebla. Although the Mexican people were later defeated by the French in subsequent battles, they were able to force Napoleon III to withdraw from their lands. Since then, the people of Mexico have celebrated Cinco de Mayo annually to honor their ancestors' strength and determination against foreign invasion. Now, normally, huge celebrations are held in Puebla and in several cities across Mexico honoring Cinco de Mayo. Reenactments, performances, and food festivals are staples of these celebrations. Within the diaspora, especially in cities with large Mexican populations from Puebla, and there's a large population in New York City of people from Puebla, public celebrations are also held. This year, however, as we find ourselves in the midst of the COVID-19 pandemic, people are celebrating from home as stay-at-home orders also remain in place in Mexico. In 2019, Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador, known as AMLO, marked the holiday at a large military celebration in northern Mexico near the U.S. border. This year, though, he is busy responding to the social economic fallout from COVID-19 as Mexico's legislative branch is set to vote on an emergency economic stimulus plan. Our guest is Gabrielle Buena.
Attention, and for the last time, please help me spread out the word. Cinco de Mayo is not Mexico's Independence Day, okay? It's not. Cinco de Mayo, we celebrate the Batalla de Puebla, the Battle of Puebla. Puebla is a state, you know, 85 miles away from Mexico City. It's just basically the victory of the Mexican army against a French army, Napoleon's army. But it is important because the French army had not been defeated in 50 years, and they came over to Mexico to collect a debt. So that's why we celebrate it. No, Cinco de Mayo is not as big as it is in America, so thank you very much for celebrating Cinco de Mayo for us. I've been here 14 years. I have never seen such a big celebration on Cinco de Mayo, parades, people on the street drinking margaritas and chips and avocado. We don't celebrate it that much. Don't say Happy Cinco de Mayo in Mexico, because they'll know you're not from Mexico. We don't say that. Maybe we say, have a nice day, but we don't say Happy Cinco de Mayo at all. So please don't confuse our Independence Day. Mexico's Independence Day is on the 16th of September, but we start celebrating it on the 15th. So don't confuse it, and I'll tell you in September why.
Today marks Cinco de Mayo, mainly celebrated in the United States, even though it has roots in Mexico. Just repeating a bit of what you might have missed earlier, the Battle of Puebla resulted in a victory for the Mexican army and defeating the French. And that was really the start of the reason Cinco de Mayo is marked. Now, normally huge celebrations are held in Puebla and several cities across Mexico honoring Cinco de Mayo, although I'm told that a lot of it mainly happens in the United States, interestingly enough. There are reenactments, performances, and food festivals are staples of these celebrations within the diaspora, especially in cities with large Mexican populations from Mexico. This is particularly true in New York City, interestingly enough. Public celebrations are also held. What I'd like to do is to welcome now our guest, Gabrielle Buelna. Dr. Gabrielle Buelna holds a doctorate in political science from the Claremont School of Politics and Economics, is a faculty member in Chicano Studies at Cal State Northridge, and a trustee at the Los Angeles Community College District. So, Gabrielle Buelna, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Okay, so clear up some confusion for us. I'm hearing two things. On the one hand, that in some parts of Mexico, generally there are large celebrations for Cinco de Mayo. On the other hand, that, well, a lot of people across Mexico don't really pay that much attention to it, and most of it happens, the celebrations happen in the United States. Is that actually true? And why, if so, why do you think that is?
Well, I think Cinco de Mayo is misunderstood. Yes, Cinco de Mayo is not Mexican Independence Day, but it is a reestablished to a certain extent of Mexican independence. And it is tied to the United States because most people, for instance, forget that September 16th is also California's Independence Day from Spain because it was our independence from the monarch. So during that time period, let me give you an example. General Ignacio Zaragoza, who was the main general during the battle in Puebla against the French, was Mexican American. He was born in what is today Texas. So to look at just Puebla and Mexico, just as Mexico under the current boundaries, no, it was because you had the Spanish, the French, and the British wanting to attack Mexico and really take control again. And it was a battle between the conservatives and the liberals, and Cinco de Mayo was basically protecting the rights of Mexico to be free of religion, to have the right of freedom of religion, freedom of speech, the liberal. And so Cinco de Mayo helped protect Mexico, reestablish its independence. So it's not a small holiday, even though the French went on to win later. The fact that Mexico, and through Ignacio Zaragoza, Benito Juarez, were able to defend Mexico showed that, you know what, we were able to kick out the French in 1812. We may have lost half of our territory in 1848, but we kept our dignity in the Battle of Puebla. And that's important to many Mexican Americans because, we're told no bilingual education, you can't speak Spanish. We lose a lot of cultural rights. So Cinco de Mayo is kind of David against Goliath. So yes, it's spread in the United States. Yes, it may be commercialized. Christmas is commercialized. That doesn't mean we don't celebrate Christmas and are always trying to find the meaning of Christmas. You know, so Cinco de Mayo is again that reestablishment. You even see actors come in the scene. Porfirio Diaz that's where he gets his, which isn't positive for Mexico. But you know, moves on to become a dictator for a few decades. But really, it's the establishment of the Mexican state of freedom of the press, removing the Catholic Church, and not the Catholic Church that we have here today. Most people forget that the Catholic Church controlled land titles, were the judges and the juries in all of Mexico. So Cinco de Mayo was profound. It sent the message that as Mexicans and as Chicanos, as Mexican Americans, we can hold our own against Goliath. And you know, so that's why Cinco de Mayo is such pride and celebrated. You know, it was celebrated in the 80s, but you had Mecha organizations in the 60s and 70s celebrating it as well. And maybe Mexican Americans did. Because again, we are constantly seeing ourselves defending ourselves against cultural imperialism. So that's what occurred and is occurring.
Right. And tell us, you know, there so many of us who live in the United States know so little about the southern neighbor, about Mexico and Mexico's history. Tell us about Mexico's first indigenous president, Benito Juarez Garcia.
Well, you had interesting Benito Juarez from the state of Oaxaca, which is, you know, one of Mexico's with the large indigenous population. That became an attorney. Most people, you know, forget that Benito Juarez was an attorney that fought as well to lead Mexico, and really, you know, as one of its first president of indigenous descent, really protected it against and wasn't against European cultural imperialism and physical imperialism, and Benito Juarez also. Also developed a strong relationship because he spent time in Louisiana with the United States and developing ties with the Union Army. So because Benito Juarez, and he was a Mason as well, and because Benito Juarez was able to develop a strong relationship using his legal skills, he was able to prevent the United States from coming in with the French and to use his powers in Washington to prevent the Spanish and the British from joining the French. So Cinco de Mayo was a triumph of indigenous diplomacy in Mexico. That's why, of course, it's a battle, you know, a battle, and yeah, it's not Mexico's independence, but there are many days of Mexico's independence because there are different Mexican independence days. But the connection toward the United States is very strong because during that time period, you know, it was a time of transition. You know, during that time period, for instance, Texas, you know, when General Ignacio Zaragoza, Texas was a free state under Mexico, did not have slavery. You know, so a lot of things changed because of the War of 1848. You know, that gave the Confederates a lot of resources, which then kind of led to a lot of tumultuousness in Mexico, which led to, you know, the French wanting to take over Mexico, install a Maximilian, and also to actually the French wanted to control American dominance in the Western Hemisphere. So it's complicated, but during that battle, Mexican indigenous forces were able to win, and that's a big deal. And that caught the spirit of Mexican Americans because we're constantly an underdog, as we can see right now with the Trump administration. We're constantly an underdog, being accused of things. You know, let's say, you know, is Biden even considering a Latina for VP? So it has modern connections towards, you know, the, you know, towards being the David and Goliath, you know, so that's the effect that it has.
Yeah, and you know, also some people are making the connection with what was going on with the French invasion, attempted invasion, and what was happening in the United States because the Civil War was underway. Do you have any thoughts about how one might have impacted the other?
Well, look, without the U.S.-Mexico War. You know, you had a lot of Confederate generals, Union generals who were trained in Mexico, and you had the South that gained. Most people forget that Arizona was a Confederate, even though it wasn't a state, it was a Confederate region. You had the growth of slavery because of the U.S.-Mexico War. Mexico was on the right side of that, was trying to prevent slavery. So you had, you know, the U.S.-Mexico War kind of propelled a lot of the resources that were able to do it. Plus, Benito Juarez assisted the Union side, and that's very important because when the Union won, they remembered and assisted Benito Juarez as an attorney. He was able to, when he spent time in the United States, he was able to set up a lot of those relationships that later benefited Mexico. And the United States did not want a French presence in Mexico because the United States also wanted to really have a, you know, kind of a hegemonic control over the Western Hemisphere. So that's why it wasn't a small battle. It really set the tone for a lot of what we're dealing with today. I have some to my YouTube channel, Buelna News or BuelnaNews.com. I have a lot of videos on a lot of these discussions, and I want to invite them. Thank you for your time.
Right. Yeah. No, I was going to ask if for people who want to be in touch with you, what they should do, and certainly visiting the website at BuelnaNews.com is one way to do that. And also, Dr. Gabriel Buelna, give us your Twitter, your handle on Twitter as well.
My handle is Gabriel_ Buelna, and feel free to follow me. And again, at YouTube, Buelna News, and subscribe. We have a new interview with we have an interview with Dolores Huerta that we did on a lot of these issues. In fact, Dolores Huerta mentioned she's been in the United States for actually her family has always been here, and we always have to remember as Mexican Americans, which Cinco de Mayo focuses on. A lot of us have always been here, and the border crossed us. So, you know, our histories are not just them, us. They affect a lot of things. And it's silly to say, oh, it's just a holiday of beer and alcohol. Well, that may be true for certain sectors, but the meanings are always there, and they always have to be retaught. Just like every other holiday, they have to be retaught as to what the core of the structure of why they existed and were created from the get-go. And that's why we're continuously learning. And that's an expectation for society in general.
Right. Well, on that note, I'm afraid we are out of time, so we're going to have to leave
Thank
it
you.
There. But Dr. Gabriel Buelna, who is a faculty member in Chicano Studies at Cal State Northridge, a trustee at the Los Angeles Community College District. Thank you for joining us, and we hope that you could join us again, Dr. Buelna.
My pleasure.
Thank you. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. What I'd like to do now is to go to our station break, and waiting in the wings to speak with us, based in Mexico City, Jose Luis Granado Ceja. And also coming up, Kenya Alcacer, a community organizer with Union de Vecinos in East Los Angeles, and she's also one of the co-chairs of the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival in California. You won't want to miss any of that. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
This is for the class. This is for the class. This is for the class. Class, class.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. That music you heard was La Raza by Kid Frost. If you're a member of Facebook, you can like and friend us on Facebook. Our handle on Twitter and Instagram at SoTrueRadio. We are also nationwide and worldwide on SoundCloud. And today, we would like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. That is Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And internationally, we would like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in Malvern East in Australia. We've got a strong listenership in Malvern East in Australia. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. It is Cinco de Mayo. And we are discussing a lot south of the border, but also communities. Later in the hour, we will be talking about communities from south of the border in the United States and how they're impacted by COVID, health-wise and also economy-wise. So as of today in Mexico, there have been at least 2,100 reported deaths and over 23,000 confirmed cases, according to the Washington Post, of COVID-19. Mexico is the second worst affected nation in Latin America after Brazil, which has at least 7,300 reported deaths and over 107,000 confirmed cases. Mexico City, the nation's capital is the worst affected area in the country in terms of both reported deaths and confirmed cases. This according to the Mexican deputy health minister. More than a quarter of the confirmed cases since COVID-19 was first detected in Mexico at the end of February have been reported in Mexico City. Close to 4,000 more confirmed cases were identified in neighboring states. Now, meanwhile, the government of Mexico, the president known as AMLO, Manuel Obrador, faces major economic and political challenges that continue to impact the country. Mexico's economy could contract by as much as 8% in 2020, according to the Associated Press, which adds that the unemployment rate could exceed 10.7% after the virus. So Mexico's indigenous peoples are particularly vulnerable to the pandemic due to grinding poverty. In the state of Chiapas, for example, where the autonomous Zapatista community is based, 76.4% of its people live below the poverty line, this according to the National Statistics Institute. Indigenous groups in southern Mexico have also expressed opposition to the construction of the Mayan train, which stretches hundreds of miles across the Yucatan Peninsula. There are lots of other issues facing Mexico. We'll be discussing all of this with our next guest. But also, before COVID-19 hit, there have been a series of mass protests in Mexico led by women against violence against women. Let us go to a clip now from the New York Times.
Que te dije que no, pendejo, no. Mi cuerpo es mío, yo le mira, tengo que mirar, yo soy mía.
Tens of thousands of women and children took to the streets for International Women's Day in Mexico City. People like Guadalupe Camacho and her three daughters. They were protesting violence against women, and specifically a rise in the number of women and girls murdered daily across Mexico, a rate that's more than doubled over the last 5 years. Names of femicide victims, more than 1,000 in 2019, were painted across the main city plaza. The crime of femicide in Mexico is murder for reasons of gender, often committed by people known to the victim. It's like a hate crime in the U.S., except here, almost none of the murders are ever solved. The vast majority marched in peace, but there was an anarchist contingent. Male journalists were chased away. The all-female police force went to guard the doors to the National Palace, when suddenly, women dressed in black threw plastic Molotov cocktails at police lines. A few of the injured were whisked away to ambulances.
Is your arm okay? Did you get burned?
Despite the bombs, the female police showed restraint. I didn't see a single arrest. The next day, these streets and businesses would be partly empty of women, as tens of thousands took part in a national strike aimed at pressuring the government to do more to stop the culture of violence against women.
All righty. And now what I would like to do is to welcome our guest. And that clip, by the way, was from the New York Times, and this was International Women's Day in Mexico City. I'd like to welcome Jose Luis Granado Ceja, a writer and photojournalist based in Mexico City. He previously worked as a staff writer for Telesur and currently works on a freelance basis. His stories focus on contemporary political issues, particularly those that involve grassroots efforts to affect social change. He often covers the work of social and labor movements in Latin America. Jose, welcome back.
Hi, I was happy to be here with you.
Okay, very good. Now, First, I'll give you an opportunity to just talk a little bit about COVID and the impact. Here in the United States, we see the most vulnerable communities who are Black, Latina, Latino, as well as Indigenous Native Americans, percentage-wise being the most impacted and also dying at alarming rates. In Mexico, are you seeing any socioeconomic impacts in terms of who's getting infected, who's dying, or is it pretty even across the board?
So, like many countries, it's unavoidable that the way that this epidemic here in Mexico, this global pandemic, is affecting people is obviously going to be informed by the socioeconomic situation of people. Mexico went through a period of neoliberal rule for many decades, and that served to effectively gut the public health system. And so the country's been faced with the challenge of how to be able to respond to the health crisis that's going to present itself, all the other countries are facing, which is, of course, this pressure on the health system that the capacity is going to be sufficient enough so that there isn't a collapse like we've seen in other cases, Ecuador, for example. And so that's been the medical situation. Fortunately, we do have a public health system, so health is recognized as a right in the Constitution here. Whether or not that's actually what's the reality on the ground in many communities is a different discussion. But nonetheless, we've seen a very fast mobilization by the government to try to build up the capacity in order to be able to have a sufficient response. And by the looks of things, the response has been so far the correct one. We're not seeing the kind of worrisome numbers that we've seen in other places like in Italy, Spain, and the United States. It looks like the strategy that has been implemented by the government thus far has been the correct one, in that while the numbers are still increasing, they are not increasing sharply, they're not increasing exponentially, and the hope is that they will be able to keep the curve flattened here in Mexico. But of course, the difficulty is that Mexico is a country that has very high levels of poverty and very high levels of informal employment. So that means that people here often live day to day. So if they don't go out to work, and we're talking about the people who eat shine shoes, who sell candies on the street, who have a taco stand, in their neighborhood, if they're not open every day, then they don't generate income. And that's probably the biggest challenge for Mexico, is that you can't have the sort of strict lockdowns where you're not allowed to leave your house under any circumstances in a country that has the economic situation that we're in. And so that has been the more difficult thing. As much as the government has been insisting that people stay at home, there's also a de facto recognition that there are communities you can't ask that of, that there are people who, if they don't leave their home, they won't be able to feed their family. And that's really the biggest challenge that we're facing now, and especially what's going to come next.
I also wanted you to comment on the fact that prior to COVID, the start of COVID in Mexico, there were mass demonstrations going on, many of them led by women, against violence against women, against femicide. And now, of course, with COVID, those protests, not only, by the way, this was going on not only in Mexico, but also in Chile and Argentina, especially around International Women's Day, where there was a call for a general strike on the ground in Mexico. How has COVID impacted those movements? Are people finding other ways to put pressure on the government to do something about not only violence against women, but any of the other social issues that people were protesting about, Jose?
Yeah, it's definitely been a challenge. And as someone who works as a journalist, it's been difficult to try to cover issues that aren't related to COVID-19, that aren't related to the coronavirus, because it's important to have a diversity of perspectives in the media landscape and to talk about issues that aren't necessarily what's top of mind for everybody right now. In terms of the women's strike, it's been difficult because in a country like Mexico, street mobilization is still the primary instrument for movement to try to put pressure on the government. I actually took part in the Women's Day demonstration that you talked about earlier here on the program. It was extraordinary. I actually probably the largest demonstration I've been to in Mexico City, apart from the commemoration of the 50th anniversary of the massacre at Zacatelco on October 2nd. It was a really extraordinary mobilization. And unfortunately, I think we have to be honest with you, that the situation is somewhat taking the wind out of the sails of the movement. It's difficult to engage in the same kinds of agitation when everybody's locked at home. And when we're talking about a population that doesn't have access to the internet in a consistent way. And so the kinds of mobilizations that are maybe possible in a country like the United States or Canada, where internet penetration is wide, but here it's been more difficult. And it's particularly worrisome because the figures just came out. And in the first trimester of the year, from January to March, it's actually one of the most violent when it comes to violence against women. There were 964 women who were killed in the country in that period, 720 of which are considered intentional homicides, and 244 femicides, which is a term that's used when gender played a role in the actual killing. So the problem hasn't gone away. In terms of the general insecurity situation in Mexico, you know, you only think that if everybody's locked down, that there's going to be less incidence of killings, but the numbers are continue to be unacceptably high, and actually the pressure on organized crime groups has actually increased in the sense that they are now branching out into different types of illegal activity because they're finding that with the quarantine measures that they're not able to move product the same way, that demand isn't the same, and so now, you know, we're starting to see real cases of people being forcibly kidnapped. And so this is a danger. This is the fallout effect of living in the situation.
Yeah, and certainly all over the world, in the United States, that same likely is true for Mexico. Domestic violence has shot up as a result of, you know, people staying indoors. You know, a lot of women are very vulnerable there. But there's a lot more we need to talk about, and you'll need to come back when we have a bit more time, Jose. But just finally, a quick comment about the position the Mexican government is in now with the Trump administration and the concessions Mexico was forced in relation to how to deal with migrants. Jose.
Mexico is in a very difficult situation right now. As you correctly identify, the prospects for an economic recovery after the pandemic is over are very grim. There are figures that range from somewhere to a contraction of almost 8%. That kind of economic contraction would be just absolutely devastating for the country. It already was a little bit shaky, but this is really firmly secure that there's going to be a major recession here. And our experience with the recessions in the past in Mexico make it so that precisely the situation that we were just talking about, violence against women, domestic insecurity, all of this is actually going to likely increase. And so the government is very much concerned about what's going to happen down the road, and is very much going to offer concessions to the United States. The United States continues to be Mexico's most important trading partner. Upwards of 80% of exports go to the United States. And so it's a relationship that can't be changed overnight. And as you said, that's going to mean that there's going to be probably more pressure by the Trump administration to continue the heavy-handed response to the migration issue inside Mexico. We're going to see a tightening down, as it is right now, because of the pandemic. There's virtually nobody migrating to Mexico, and the borders have effectively been sealed, and the people that did find themselves in Mexico have actually been deported. But once, you know, the situation approaching normal, we're likely to see the same kinds of, you know, detaining of migrants by the National Guard, the jailing of migrants, the prevention of them being able to access the northern border, the Mexico-U.S. border, and that's likely to continue as a result of the economic concessions that Mexico is seeking from the United States in order to revitalize the economy.
Right. On that note, I'm afraid we are going to have to leave it there, Jose Luis Granado Ceja, but please come back soon. And you know, there's a lot more. There's a lot going on the ground in Mexico that we just weren't able to get to today, but we appreciate your work and we appreciate you taking the time to join us. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. I would now like to wrap up our show by welcoming to Sojourner Truth Kenya Alcocer, community organizer with Union de Vecinos, which is based in East Los Angeles. And she is also one of the California co-chairs of the Poor People's Campaign, A National Call for Moral Revival. And Kenya and her organization, Union de Vecinos, they have been some of the leading forces on the rent strikes that have taken place in Southern California that are part of a national movement. Kenya Alcocer, thank you for joining us.
Good morning, Margaret. Thank you for having us.
Okay, Kenya, a couple of things. One, before we get to the rent strikes, when we're looking at how, well, this is also part of the rent strikes, how COVID has impacted immigrant communities, in particular Latino communities, not only in Southern California, but across the United States in terms of health, but also in terms of the economy, Kenya.
Yeah, I mean, the impact has been great on immigrant communities. As you know, a lot of those folks are actually considered essential workers at the moment, but without any support or help from the government to actually continue working safely. We just heard that some of the farm workers in Florida, for example, are just getting medical equipment to get tested. Or tests actually being provided to them. We have folks here in Central Valley that are continuing to work to pick our fruits and vegetables, and yet there's hardly any protections. And when protections are coming, especially like for example here in the state of California, there are folks that are trying to block some of those benefits or some of that support. When it comes to immigrant families that have folks that are incarcerated in detention centers currently, the fight is to help some of those folks get freed or out of those detention centers, because we know that the pandemic has hit jails and detention centers hard as well. So, I mean, there's just a lot of issues and hurt happening within the Latino community due to COVID-19. The financial hurt has been one of them, and obviously one of the ways that we are trying to alleviate some of that pain is by asking folks to, if they cannot pay their rent, to choose food over rent. And that is what the rent strike ultimately does, is asking folks to choose life over death. And part of the work that we are trying to do, not just as Unión de Vecinos, but as the Poor People's Campaign, is to really center the demands that were here before the crisis that are just very so much needed, and that is housing, health care, and a living wage.
Right, and some people go as far to say before the COVID-19 pandemic, there was the pandemic of poverty in the United States, where the Poor People's Campaign talks about 140 million people in the U.S., either poor or at risk of right on the poverty line. And among those, more than 70% are women and children. Kenya, I'd like you to talk a little bit more about the rent strikes, but also in terms of the impact of COVID in Los Angeles. Looking at the numbers from the county of Los Angeles, we see that the Hispanic Latino deaths, as I'm looking at it now, is around 431. Among Black people, it's 144. And in fact, Hispanic and Latino deaths are higher in this county than any other grouping. And sometimes people forget about that. We have to remember that as well. But Kenya, for people who want to perhaps find out more about the rent strike, how to participate, how it works, or about the work of Union de Vecinos as well as the Poor People's Campaign, tell us a little bit about those, what they should do.
Yes, I mean, if they want to learn more about the rent strike, they can go to LA Tenants, the LA Tenants Union website, which is latu.org, latu.org. or go to foodnotrent.org and they will get a package which will give them step-by-step on what to do if they cannot pay their rent. There's a notice there that they can give to their landlords. For the rent struck, for the most part, one of the things that we want to make sure is people are protected, and the way that they can protect themselves is by documenting the fact that they cannot pay their rent. So sending out the notice to your landlord is actually protecting you from a future eviction. And the fight is to ensure that there is rent and mortgage forgiveness, to make sure that folks are not being asked to pay back this rent, because that is only putting people into more debt. And then in some cases, putting them into debt to their landlords that will eventually evict them. So that is part of like that fight. If they want to learn a little bit more about the Poor People's Campaign, they can go to the poorpeoplescampaign.org. But if they are here in California and want to learn more, they can go to the Facebook pages, the California Poor People's Campaign, and send us a message there. We can connect them to the regions that are currently activated. If there's nothing happening in your region, then you can be the first one to start something in your region and get involved. And that is like the thing that we are asking folks. Today is Cinco de Mayo, and one of the things that we want to remind folks is that in Cinco de Mayo, it's not Mexican Independence Day, just to start. It is a fight in Puebla with the French against like people in Mexico. The fight was supposed to be won by the French, since they had all the equipment and the means to really kill and win this battle. But the reality is that the Mexican community got together and fought back against the French, who were trying to take over.
Yeah, Kenya, we actually covered that in some depth with a segment at the top of the hour, and I'm afraid we are really short of time right now. But thank you for reminding everybody that it is not Mexican Independence Day at Cinco de Mayo, celebrating the defeat of the French, right, at the city of Puebla.
Well, the thing is that we have the opportunity for poor people to actually come together during this crisis and push back against what the elite is asking of us. And
right, we are literally...
We can't go back to the normal.
Not one step back, but we literally are out of time, I'm afraid. Kenya, we'll have you back, of course. Thank you so very much for your work, and thank you for joining us.
I want to thank all of today's guests. Today's show produced by me, that's Margaret Prescott, and I'd like to thank our Sojourner Truth team, our engineer today, Mr. T. Teddy Robinson, our assistant producer, Romero Funes. If you'd like a copy of today's show, please contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go online to pacificaradioarchives.org. Thank you for listening. Please stay safe. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. When we used to sit in the government yard in Trenchtown, hoba hoba serving the hypocrites as they would mingle with the good people we met. Good friends we have, oh, good friends we've lost.
Thank you. KBOO Portland.
Today is Giving Tuesday. Giving Tuesday is a global day dedicated to sparking generosity and citizen engagement around the world. This year, your support is needed more than ever. If you appreciate